There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, Assistant Editor of the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking to Hedwig Emilia Waters, Horizon Europe ERA Postdoctoral Fellow at Palackovsky University, the Czech Republic. We're discussing her new book, Moral Economic Transitions in the Mongolian Borderlands. This book features a detailed case study of a remote area located in Mongolia along the Chinese border during its transition from socialism to a market-based economy. This transition has brought both rapid economic change and political backlash from rural citizens. Hedwig detailed the many layers of transition with great thought and attention. Hedwig, thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me, Caleb.
Of course. You know, this book was really fascinating. I've done about four or five books on borderlands, and I just find borderlands to be endlessly interesting locations, great for studies, because they're usually function a little differently, have interesting politics. But before jumping to the book, I was just wondering if you'd tell us a little about yourself and your background.
I describe myself as an economic anthropologist, mostly because of the different work I have done throughout the years and kind of the focus of the book as well. So my anthropology fieldwork has always been focused on Mongolia so far. I first went to Mongolia in 2006 as an undergraduate study abroad student, and I went there to live with wanted an adventure. So I went and lived with nomadic pastoral herders in the taiga region of northern Mongolia in Siberia. And, I loved it. And so it started a long-term relationship with the country that's now been almost 17 years. So I've gone back every few years through the last decade or more and doing different projects. And to just explain why I call myself an economic anthropologist or what I focus on, So Mongolia, and we're going to get into that too, but it was a socialist republic up until 1991, at which point it started the transition, quote unquote, to a market democracy. And I say transition also because in Mongolian people call it a transition. So that's what I'm referring to when I use that term. And all of my fieldwork throughout the last decade or more has been focused on how different concepts of like Mongolian, so first of all, Mongolian struggles to create this market economy, but also like how Mongolian concepts of culture, morality, historical cosmologies, interactions with the land, also gender ideas, how all these things have engaged with this shift to a market economy. So I guess because of that, my research has always been on this nexus of political economy and cultural like exemplars or ideas. That's why I use that term.
So for this particular book, was there a moment when the idea first came to you or an experience that you had where the book started to crystallize?
the way that came about is when I did my PhD at University College London at UCL in the Department of Anthropology between 2014 and 2019. And at the time I was in this big EU-funded anthropology project. So it was like many people and I was a PhD student in it. And so the book kind of emerged from that project. And so the background of that project is that so Mongolia, as I mentioned in my experience moving there and living in the Taiga region, is a country that's often well-known internationally as having a lot of pastoral herders. So pastoral herders being people who live and move around with their animals and live off of them. So in Mongolia, still like 10% of the population are herders, so 300,000 people. And at the same time, though, in 2011, so in the early 2000s, vast amounts of mineral resources were discovered in Mongolia. And so in 2011, Mongolia had the fastest growing economy in the world. Kind of, it was like a rush, a mineral rush on the country. So the project that I was in was about this kind of contrast of like the stark contrast of like the herder who overnight gets like thrust into this like hyper globalized, financialized mineral economy. And so the project's focus was to look at how different people all around the country have like adapted or changed or like how it like alters their lives. So as a PhD student, I was encouraged to go just as far away as possible. So I moved. So when I started my PhD field work, I went in 2015 to the area that I talk about in the book that I call Mugtal. So we'll talk about that in a second. But I lived with a family in Mugtal for on and off for over 2 years, and I did my field work with them. And so again, like the project's focus was to see how like all sorts of people were being affected by this like abstract mineral financialized economy. And so I was living in this small town and kind of was focused on that, like how are these different phenomena from the city or from like a global perspective now percolating down or affecting local and people here in this remote area. So and then as part of that project, then ultimately the book emerged, which is why it was published with UCL Press.
You've already mentioned a little bit about this major economic transition that occurred in Mongolia and some of the impacts that it had, but would you get into a little bit more why this transition occurred? Was it just the result of the collapse of the Soviet Union? Was there something else at play as well?
I mean, several things, but of course the largest factor was the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, Mongolia, for those who don't know, is pretty isolated country. It's sequestered between Russia and China. So it almost exclusively, so besides Kazakhstan, but it's pretty isolated. But it was seen as a buffer zone between Russia and China. So technically Mongolia wasn't a Soviet republic, it was a socialist republic. But during the Soviet era, Russia did flood it with funds because it was supposed to be in like Marxist or Soviet teleology, transition to socialism from feudalism, capitalism, and then socialism. But so Mongolia went ideally from feudalism to socialism directly. So the Soviet government gave it a lot of money to like create this like idealized example of how you could do that. And so point being is that like up, I think at the end of the socialist era in Mongolia, they're up like around a third of all income was from the Soviet Union directly. So as a result, when the transition happened or when the Soviet Union collapsed, of course, the Mongolian government just did not have the funds to maintain itself. And at the time, the countryside during the Soviet era was full of cooperatives, and also Mugtal was a cooperative that we'll discuss soon. But the transition happened, and so it was partly that the Soviet system, the Socialist Republic, couldn't maintain itself. But of course, there were also interests in the early 90s. Many Mongolian politicians or various politicians also wanted Mongolia to implement best practice in terms of like international, at the time, like structural adjustment or like kind of advice from the international, from the World Bank and International Monetary Fund and different development programs. So there was also that desire, partly in the government and also externally. So that resulted in, you know, rapid privatization of many of the cooperatives and a quick change. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, of course. I think that that's really great background, just for, you know, some of the other things that we'll be discussing and that you really look at firsthand. You mentioned Mactal. Why do you call the area, your area of focus, Mactal? And what can you tell us about this place and its features?
Okay. Well, as will become more clear, but the reason why I call it Mugtash, which is like with me having a Mongolian accent on it, but Mactal, the reason I call it that or gave it this name is, you know, as anthropologists, it's very important that when people talk to us, they feel comfortable. So a lot of activity that I encountered, but that people were doing in their everyday lives was technically illegal or informal. And so in order for people to speak openly to me and feel comfortable, I had to guarantee that it would be, everything would be anonymized. So I chose this term for the place. So Mactash itself in Mongolian means like a hymn of praise. And it's the, I chose this term also because it's the furthest eastern region in Mongolia. So Mongolia itself looks like a, so like a kind of like a shape of like an American football, and it's like on the eastern end of it, like the eastern tip. And so I thought like a hymn of praise to the sun or something. That's the way I was thinking about it when I gave it this term. But I've talked to many Mongolians since then who like it, so I think it seems to be pretty applicable. So the town itself, it takes like 2 to 3 days to travel there from Ulaanbaatar over unpaved roads. And then you reach this tiny town, but it's like a very large township. It's a huge land area. And the township itself is just around 1,700 people, or the whole area is around 3,000 people. And the people that live there are mostly herders. So these pastoral herders I was talking about, or also ex-workers who worked in the cooperative when Mactash was a Soviet or socialist cooperative during the Soviet socialist era. But then, of course, as the cooperative collapsed in 1991, all the cooperatives were dissolved through a privatization law. And so as the cooperative was dissolved, all the people who used to work there then were unemployed overnight. So, and that was a phenomenon across the rural regions in Mongolia and in also the post-socialist world. So, and in Mactash then, most people became unemployed very quickly. But so you could call it a de-industrialized area. But so what happened as a result, though, is in the 90s, there was like rapid inflation because the Tugruk, the Mongolian, you know, currency was worth, or wasn't worth a lot. There wasn't high demand. And there was a lot of barter. And as the Mongolian border opened up to China, many people didn't have other forms of employment. So they started. So Mactash itself is like an incredibly rich resource area. It's got very fertile soils, and it's a very large steppe environment. And so kind of a unique ecological environment. So when the border to China opened up and people had no forms of employment or were unemployed, many people just learned to, first they went to the former Soviet cooperatives and stripped them of scrap metal and then sold it to China. And then after that, it kind of, they graduated to the environment, and then they started going around also with Chinese encouragement at the time in the early 90s or in the late 90s rather. Different Chinese entrepreneurs also came across the border, looked at what kind of resources were available, and kind of and informed the populace of what kind of things could be sold in China. So because it's such a resource-rich area, the population that was unemployed but left started developing this tendency to basically make their money off of resource extraction from the environment that was then brought across the border and sold in China. As the state, or like the Mongolian state system emerged after that, a lot of their activities slowly became illegalized. So technically, they might be illegal. And that's why when I talk to you know, different people as an anthropologist. I wanted to make them feel comfortable. So I told them that everything they told me would be anonymized. So in the book, there are like little, like, I can think of a story, for example, of one person who lost some, like, I think I write that they lost toes in a tractor accident. But because I knew that if anybody read the book, they'd know, oh, that person is this person. And I didn't want that. So I changed what, like, kind of what they lost or the physical injury they had, you know, things like that. I kind of, in addition to changing Mugtash as a place, I changed like very obvious markers of people.
Were people very, you know, forthcoming with the information that they gave you, or, you know, did you have to win people's trust?
So it's a great question. It's two-sided. So first of all, I lived there over 2 years, right? And so I was, and it's very far away. I was the only foreigner that people had seen, like, when I say foreigner, I mean non-Chinese or Russian individual. So who is there? And so people were very confused. Even my homestay father, the family I lived with, often asked me why exactly I'm here, because I would be there for, you know, an anthropology student. Like, you don't really know what you're looking for when you start. You move to an area and then you tell people, though, who are generally just trustful because they also have a history of war and spies and things, that you're just there to like figure out the economy and you're in like in an economic anthropology project. And people are like, you know, I did get my own homestay dad was like, are you sure you're not a spy? I mean, I like you and you can stay, but like, are you sure? And I'm like, really, I'm not a spy. This is really just me doing field work. But I understood from their perspective why it seemed weird. Like, you would think that's weird too, I think, in these kind of sensitive areas. So regarding if they were open, so because I was like a student and there for so long, and, you know, I spoke Mongolian fairly well, I think just the novelty of it. And I also think I just like, as an anthropologist, you have to listen to people. And I think like in some ways, like in hindsight, I think like it was like a therapy, like I think I served like a therapy role for some people, like when they feel like they're not, like they're doing something they don't love, or like illegal, they don't love it, but they feel like they have to. And then like when I interview them and I'm like very understanding, I feel like people, sometimes it came out, especially in my more recent work where we can discuss it because it's an extension of this. But people, I feel like, felt like sometimes, like once they had trusted me, they felt like they wanted to talk to me because like I would ask them questions that their family and friends didn't care about, you know.
What else can you share about the culture of the area and you know, also the types of, you know, jobs and both legal and illegal economic activity taking place in the area?
I mentioned that it was a cooperative during the Soviet era, and then that collapsed or was dissolved. And there were many ex-workers there. At the time, the narrative very strongly, like culturally, was like in my field site specifically, was that there was like, that the state had like abandoned us, like that was, or that it was like a very strong feeling of neglect. Like during the Soviet Union, you know, there was a lot more like everyday awareness of the state being present, whereas now it wasn't. And in contrast to some other work where people talk about that like local groups, like local or like rural populations might find that positive, it's like a sign of freedom. In Mugtash, it was people were angry about it. And so so there's like a very strong feeling of like anger at being neglected and people having to do like new forms of entrepreneurial, like I mentioned, resource extraction to make ends meet. Not because they loved it, but because there was no other like option. And in general, the area has become very much like a resource frontier for both Russia and China. And now, and also at the time when I was there, there were increasingly like large companies coming that were had as their heads like parliamentary members, Mongolian parliamentary members, with either funding from Russia or China, or Chinese companies that came to the area. To set up either agricultural companies or oil companies, but they wouldn't employ local people. So it created this kind of parallel economy where you had like these big companies that would get all their employment and like their employees and also products from Ulaanbaatar, the capital city, and then exported abroad. And like none of the money would stay locally. whereas local people would have to engage in these like illegal activities. So that was very much the tenor, or like how, like kind of the political economy when I was there. And that's why people also like griped a lot about being neglected. Like they wouldn't be able to participate in these companies and the government wasn't even paying attention. It was what they would say. So regarding the major economic activities, so those like big companies would, you know, there's a Chinese oil company. There are these large agricultural companies with parliament heads, whereas local people very much made, so, and we can talk about that too, but the major economic culture was that during the most of the year, people would take out debt from banks to like sustain their lives. And then in the fall, when it was like resource season, people would smuggle like different forms of wildlife. So in the book, I talk a lot about fish because that was the family I was in, but there's also antelope and wolves. And then also a big form of industry locally is a plant called feng feng. And so I don't know if you've heard of ginseng, because that's like a big, very popular kind of Asian traditional medicine plant. But so feng feng is an emerging market very similar to ginseng, where feng feng is essentially a traditional Chinese medicinal plant. And so many, many people in my field site made money that they paid bank loans off of through feng feng. So it was just a phenomenon. When I was there in 2017, the whole town, technically it was illegal, but the whole town would go out picking feng feng and making money off of it. So essentially these during the year when they didn't have income, debt, and then in the fall paying that back through feng feng or other forms of wildlife.
Use the phrase moral economic dichotomization to refer to aspects of this economic shift and different ways in which people are perceiving the shifts in the economy. What do you mean by this phrase?
Yes, that's a good question. So the term moral economy is first this moral economic dichotomization that I use, and that is also partly in the title of the book, is inspired by the concept moral economy first off. The term moral economy is used a lot in social sciences, and anthropology, sociology, and other social sciences to describe economic behavior that is not driven by rational choice. So in, of course, like Western economics or economic theory, a lot, it's often depicted that people make decisions based on rationality and self-interest or economic profit. But moral economy is often used in social sciences to depict examples where people are driven to make economic choices based on morality, religion, and other forms of value. And so an example being like that people like Christmas buy a bunch of, you know, aren't necessarily driven by economic self-interest, but they are driven by morality or like different self forms of morality or religion to participate in economic enterprise. So you could write a moral economy of Christmas, for example, book if you were so inclined. But that's how it's generally used. And so in the book, I use this term because a lot of people, or like I use the term moral economic dichotomization specifically because I encountered a lot of people who were, you know, like I mentioned, they were engaged in activity, but a lot of the activities like this extraction many people felt uncomfortable with this situation because of historical ideas of morality. So what I mean is that during socialism, for example, the idea of profiteering off of other people, like being a moneylender and making money off of the interest of somebody else's livelihood would have been deemed immoral. And then also during, like, according to Mongolian historical ideas of shamanism and Buddhism, digging the land, like with feng feng extraction or other forms of wildlife extraction, would have been deemed immoral. So as a result of that, many people were now in Magtash were now dependent on these forms of enterprise, but did not love it. And so I found that often when I would then ask them how they talked about it or how they justified this, they would create these frameworks that I call moral economic dichotomization. And to give an, a specific example is like from like a Western context, is that if, for example, in like Christian-inspired concepts of morality, a loan, if you get debt, for example, from a bank, and you use it to spend on your family or to go to school or to, you know, to reach some goal in your life, people tend to think of that as like morally okay. But if you took debt out and you wasted the money and you just like went on a shopping spree, often people would say that debt is, this kind of debt is immoral or not ideal. So just as an example, like as an example of that, when I asked people in Muktash about if they liked extraction, if they liked being, you know, the forms of money lending or and their dependence on it, often people created frameworks where they would say, oh, it's okay if I'm doing it in this way. You know, being dependent on a money lender is okay if they're helping me in a time of need. But, you know, I call them, they're an extractor. If they are getting too much interest off of me, they, as it's called, a user. Or extraction is okay if the money is going back to the community and the family and it's helping us survive and maintain our livelihoods. But extraction is not okay if it's if the money is in larger proportions going to China and it's not staying here or helping our lives. So people would often create these frameworks of when certain people or certain activities were moral or not. So that's why I use the term moral economic dichotomization to describe that. But another aspect that I think is important to emphasize regarding this term is that, and I mentioned that there's that the word moral economy, of course, moral economy is in this term. So the reason I also chose this as like a compound moral economy is because it's when people use these dichotomizations, it's often indicative of a moment where that person themselves is seeing moral and economic as two different frameworks that they of society that they have to measure, to have to balance against. So what I mean is, like, for example, even in English, we talk about that there's economic value, which people associate with money, like what a price is on a market. And then there's social values. And so we often, when we think of social values, we think of religion, we think of different forms of communal morality. And so we ourselves put those into two different worlds. We fracture value into two different in different categories. And so when I was doing this field work, I noticed that when I would be in these moments where people felt uncomfortable about what they were doing, but felt economic pressure, that this kind of top-down pressure encouraged people to see economy or economic value and social values as like a polarity or two different realms of society that needed to be negotiated. And so that's also why I decided moral economy would still, like, moral economic dichotomization would be a good term for this kind of moment.
Would you say that there's a sense among the people that you spoke with that markets and capitalism is a necessary evil, or do they sort of yearn for the socialist past?
You know, I've been going to Mongolia for 17 years, and I feel like you can see a lot of shifts with that. But with, like, in these, like, kind of more rural places, a very common trope I encountered was, like, the kind of 50 to 60 year old individual who was the last generation of like socialism, who very much wished they could go back. So it's like a very common phenomenon. Also, I think throughout the post-socialist world is a lot in these rural regions, like kind of people who worked for these cooperatives and believed in it and who now wish they could go back. Regarding capitalism, yeah, I mean, the general, yes. So at that time, very much so, that the feeling was like, this is the way the world is now, and we have to figure out the best way to negotiate it so that it's a necessary evil. Yeah, I do think that you could describe it that way.
It's really fascinating how significant the banking system is in people's day-to-day lives, you know, how they depend on loans. Does banking, you know, function differently there than it might in the West? What are the banks there? How do they operate primarily?
Does banking function differently? I mean, I think that's part of the pride of banking industry that it doesn't, right? That's part of their modus operandi, is that they go around the world and they implement similar like systems and narratives and concepts. But so how banking functions in this rural field site where I was, you know, in the early 2000s, a bank started moving out into rural regions. A commercial bank went out more into rural regions of Mongolia, and you know, with the intention, of course, of like helping rural people who might need a loan to create new forms of enterprise, and that was very much encouraged. So, starting in the 2000s and 2010s, increasingly banks moved to rural areas, and you know, this like cliched term, banking the unbanked, but that was very much a goal at that time, and it did work. I mean, rural Mongolians actively engaged in banking options. There are some differences, of course. I mean, the most obvious one being is that, of course, herders themselves, pastoral herders, would like to have loans, but their only form of collateral is, of course, their herds. So there are some very innovative banking tech, like loan systems of, for example, using a herd as like a form of collateral. Those tend to be very short-term loans because of the risk that banks associate with having a herd as your collateral form. But still, that exists. But I think for the basic tenets of it is similar. You have a collateral form. You can take out a loan. You have a salary, a contract, and you can take out a loan. But with the rural region specifically where I was, but I think this is common in many areas. So in the 2000s and towards the 2010s, more and more the government also subsidized loans as like a development form, so that, for example, rural people, again, banking the unbanked, could also have loans to create new forms of enterprise. But when you're very rural and you're in like Mongolia and you don't have very many people to sell something to, because, you know, there's only like this township, for example, is only 1,700 people. Many people took out banks, but weren't able to really pay them. Many people took out loans, but weren't really able to pay them back because there's only so many bakers a town can have, right? So as a result of that, it became very common in Mongolia and Mugtash specifically to take out a loan and to take out another loan and to use that money to pay off the first loan. And so some of the, in Mugtash, but also in Mongolia, this is a common phenomenon, is that there's just like very messy loan networks where people are taking money out from one loan and paying another loan. And so everybody's, and also friend and family groups help each other. So if I need to pay back money, then my dad can take out a loan, give me that money, and I use it to pay the interest. And so it just became this form of chronic indebtedness where everyone had multiple loans and they were just kind of moving money back and forth in order to pay off each other's loans, resulting in this kind of chronic indebtedness but nobody is really able to free themselves of the loan.
Yeah, that sounds maybe something that seemed like it was very likely to happen in a place where people weren't used to taking loans out.
Sure. It's also based on the idea that, I mean, one thing is, of course, the credit system itself in Mongolia. I don't even know if you have such thing as a credit score. So, and also everything is credit itself is based on the idea that you have the technology to monitor it. And if you are in an area where just the technology for these things doesn't exist, then you can't monitor it. And so it has no value. But another thing that really the contrast with Mongolia and compared to other places is that the idea alone is based on a concept of an individual's morality, so that an individual takes out a loan and it's their own like ability to pay it back. And it's like a responsibility they carry. And when you live in a place where people live in really tight friend and family groups, those loans often took on the burden of the whole family. And so you never had just one person trying to pay it back. And so that's really what resulted, is that these kind of, there's like with a lot of this, there's like a clash between the individualistic ideas and a lot of these like new market forms or forms of law even that arrived in Mongolia with the clash they clashed often with like local narratives of families, like groups helping each other, like being very close, or everybody knowing each other in a township.
So in what ways is Mugtach Tuck both an example of many places, pardon my pronunciation.
No worries.
in what ways is it both an example of many places in a state of economic transition? And in what ways is Mugtach an exception?
Okay, so we touched upon this, I think, but in some ways it's like kind of like typical in the sense of like a lot of these like rural areas in this post-socialist world where these cooperatives collapsed and people wish they could go back, you know, and that these areas are now deindustrialized and people feel like abandoned or neglected or they don't have infrastructure anymore. So that's kind of classic from that angle. It's also from the viewpoint of like a developing country, becoming part of the international global market system. It's pretty classic in that it became like a resource frontier, you know, like that it's like full of cheap resources. And so, and that without the ability, especially with the collapse of all the cooperatives from after, during privatization, without the ability for local people to actually refine those resources so that they sell these resources at very cheap prices on the international market. And that also, you know, Mongolia as like a resource frontier too, you know, Mongolia's got virgin untouched soil and resources, organic resources that are like impossible to find in many of these surrounding countries, like in Korea, South Korea, or Japan or China at the moment. So that creates this pressure where Mongolia becomes like a source of cheap nature, really, for other industrialized markets in the region. But Mugtach specifically, when I was there, was pretty exceptional in the fact that people were all engaged in these kind of smuggling networks or these wildlife networks, but they very much had the sense, but because we were all neglected together, that we will help each other. So Mugtach was pretty exemplary in the sense that it was people at the time in particular, which has changed a little bit since then, people really helped each other a lot. It was like a rural region where people were all felt neglected. And so when they would engage in these smuggling activities, they would work together in groups to do so. So there's like some like history you could argue from like kind of carryover from the socialist era, historical forms of like labor pooling, like herders helping each other out. But there was definitely features of that in Mugtach at the time.
Since you first went to the region to conduct research for the book, what has changed? You know, what's the state? If you know what the state has been recently or even now, what things are like?
Yeah, so since then, so I mentioned this Fang Feng trade. So since then, actually through coronavirus, the Chinese government declared Fang Feng like an official Chinese traditional medicine plant against coronavirus. So the price of organic Fang Feng, so not even like cultivated in China Fang Feng, but this like untouched resource, tripled right during coronavirus. So as a result of that, this Fang Feng pressure has really like increased. But what has changed is, for example, during coronavirus, of course, the Chinese government closed its borders. So money Mugtach people could not make their money off of these kind of forms of extraction anymore. And since then, the borders have opened again, and these things have continued in force again. But people, for example, picked Fang Feng, but they had to engage in new kind of smuggling networks where they had to make deals with people in the city to extract it under like international contract or like export it under international contracts. And in addition to that, Fang Feng as like a plant that people can openly pick, the like illegalization has gotten harder or harsher now. So the penalty if you are caught. So the result is essentially like compared to then, when everybody was engaging in this and they were helping each other, there's been a lot more like monopolization and like kind of underground networks emerging. So like local people making deals with people who have international permissions to extract, to like export things. So this, when I was there, it was very much like this moment where a lot of these new enterprises were emerging and there was still like a bounty of resources. And so people were helping each other do so. But compared to then, with the closing of the border, it's basically, and also the increased illegalization, it's made it much, much more of like almost like an underground drug trade now. So like a lot of, so you can see how quickly something shifts from this like, oh, we're all engaging the economy and helping each other together, to like, oh, now we have to create these kind of like networks, these underground networks to export these things. So there's been, through these things, and a more, I would say, monopolization and kind of cartel-esque development.
Has there been an increase in violence at all?
No, because Mongolia in general is a very peaceful country, luckily. So, I mean, I was able to do research about an illegal topic, but because of features of illegality in Mongolia, it's not very, well, the specific features being that there is a huge discrepancy between the law on paper and how things are actually done on the day-to-day level, especially in rural regions. And because of that, the law doesn't have the same, like, doesn't have the same bite. And so, like, penalization, essentially. And so as a result of that, like, there hasn't been more violence. Like, people, even in rural Mongolia, don't often get back. Like, I think it's a contrast to if you lived in, like, a city where there are very few resources, and then if you are being penalized for something, then you're really being backed into a corner. You don't, like, you feel there's, like, an existential angst. In Mongolia or in rural areas, especially because of still, there's just a lot of open land and a lot of resources. When something becomes illegal, it doesn't have the same existential angst, especially even if you get penalized for it. And so as a result of that, there's been more underground networks, but the actual physical violence hasn't emerged yet. And I hope it doesn't.
So with this project, are there any other areas of study that you're looking at, you know, in regards to Mongolia, in regards to the Mactouch or anything else at all?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of touched upon this, but like, basically I have right now a European research, like a European Union fellowship to do research on the Feng Feng trade. So when I was in Mactouch, I was very interested in how everybody was engaging in this plant. And also there remains to be no awareness of it in like English speaking material, but it's right now like a phenomenon in like the traditional medicinal world. So in Asia, and so I wanted to see how, you know, I basically got a grant to look at the Feng Feng trade and also licorice root, which is another plant highly desirable in traditional medicinal industries across Asia, and how these plants are being extracted and other plants in Mongolia are being extracted for these traditional medicinal resource network, like kind of the industries. So essentially, as I mentioned, a lot of in these plants are deemed highly desirable because they're rare and organic, but kind of untouched soil and untouched plants are almost non-existent in industrialized countries anymore. So that opens up Central Asia and in this case, Mongolia, to be a large source of cheap labor, especially if the law hasn't been developed enough to prevent this from happening. So that is the case right now that this, so I am currently looking at these networks and how Mongolia has become a source of this kind of these plants for the East Asian and Chinese traditional plant market.
That sounds really interesting, and you know, certainly something that, you know, I'd not heard about until you discussed it. Well, Hedwig, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. It was really interesting to talk to you about this about Mongolia and the particular aspects of the economy and this region that you studied. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and letting me rant a bit about Mongolia, rant and share about Mongolia and, you know, traditional medicinal plant markets.
Of course, that's what we do. Yeah, thank you so much.